Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Sasha hated sand, the way it stuck to things for weeks. So when Maddie shared a surf trip on Expedia Trip Planner, he hesitated. Then he added a hotel with a cliffside pool to the plan. And they both spent the week in the water. You were made to follow your whims. We were made to help find a place on the beach with a pool and a waterfall and a soaking tub and, of course, a great shower. Expedia. Made to travel.
Unmissable stories from around the globe. From the BBC World Service.
My happy place. This is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 13th of February, these are our main stories. President Biden has described the more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah as exposed and vulnerable, and warned Israel they need to be protected. Germany's Chancellor has called for a dramatic increase in arms manufacturing in Europe. And Ukraine has reacted angrily to a protest by Polish farmers who emptied the contents of several Ukrainian lorries in a dispute over cheap grain imports. Also coming up in this podcast. It's 100 years since George Gershwin's musical composition Rhapsody in Blue had its premiere in New York City. We're going to start, though, in Washington, D.C., where President Biden has appealed for the more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah to be protected, describing them as exposed and vulnerable. He was speaking at the White House after meeting the Jordanian monarch, King Abdullah.
The major military operation in Rafah should not proceed without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there. They need to be protected. And we've also been clear from the start, we oppose any forced displacement of Palestinians from Gaza.
Well, Jordan's king made these remarks regarding the conflict in Gaza following the Hamas attack on Israel on October the 7th.
All attacks against innocent civilians, women and children, including those of October 7th, cannot be accepted by any Muslim, as I had previously stressed. We must make sure the horrors of the past few months since October 7th, are never repeated nor accepted by any human being.
King Abdullah of Jordan, and before that, the US President Joe Biden. Well, earlier, the US State Department defended Israeli airstrikes on the city of Rafah in support of Monday's hostage rescue operation. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says around 100 Palestinians were killed in the strikes. Meanwhile, senior United Nations officials have stepped up calls for Israel to refrain from undertaking a fully fledged military operation in the city in the south of Gaza. The UN human rights chief, Volker Turk, was speaking after the Israeli operation to rescue the two hostages. And later, Hamas claimed that three hostages it was holding, who were injured in recent Israeli airstrikes, have now died. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philippe Lazzarini, said order in Rafah was breaking down. Speaking in Brussels on Monday, he said it was increasingly difficult to operate in the city.
Yesterday, for the first time, the UN could not operate with a minimum of protection, which was the local police. And because we had no local police, our trucks, our convoys at the border have been looted. And trucks have been vandalized by hundreds of young people. The last remaining, I would say, protection to keep a minimum of civil order, which was the local police, might not be functional anymore, since many of them have been killed over the last few days and are more and more reluctant to be seen in these convoys.
What about the people who actually live there? most of whom have fled from the north of Gaza on the orders of Israel's military. Well, Ghada El-Kurd has moved 6 times in 4 months with her children, and she's now sheltering at a relative's home in Rafah.
The Israeli military operation will start soon. We are waiting to the Israeli forces to throw some flyers telling us where to evacuate. This has happened before, and even they are published on their social media platforms where to evacuate.
Well, Israel's military insists, though, that it will target Rafah and what it says is the remaining Hamas militants based in the city. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the Israel Defense Force said it was working to limit the impact on civilians, though, by moving them to safety.
The government has instructed the IDF to create a plan of action, which includes, of course, both the operational plan to achieve our military goals of dismantling and destroying Hamas and bringing home the hostages, but also a plan that evacuates civilians, non-involved, non-combatants from the potential combat areas. There are less people or no people in the centre in the north of Gaza. There are other places that they can be moved.
Well, for more, I spoke to our correspondent Nick Beek, who's in Jerusalem, and I asked him if there was any news of a possible plan by Israel to give safe passage to those in Rafah before it carried out a ground operation.
The Prime Minister here, Benjamin Netanyahu, has instructed the military bosses to come up with this plan to move this huge amount of people. 1.5 million is the estimate. And that population of the city of Rafah, 5 times what it was just a few months ago. And it's not a built-up city. Most people are living in tents. And they're saying that there's a lack of clean water, lack of food, lack of medicine, lots of aid agencies saying that it's a really perilous situation. So, yeah, we await to see what sort of plan the Israeli army has drawn up, because, of course, the idea is they move people out and then afterwards they go in and hit Hamas hard. They're talking about four remaining battalions that they need to wipe out.
Yesterday we heard from Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, who sounded utterly adamant in his personal determination to push on with the last remaining military operation into Rafah. Is there any sense that the warnings from the UN, calls with President Biden, are going to make him think again or going to limit his actions, do you think?
For now, there is absolutely no sign that it's making any impact whatsoever. As you say, the Americans, whether that's Antony Blinken, the US's top diplomat who was here, the Secretary of State, also President Biden, we know he had a 45-minute phone call with Mr. Netanyahu yesterday. You've got David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, the Foreign Minister, saying today that he says it's basically impossible to see how a military operation can be fought with so many people there in Rafah who, in his words, have nowhere to go. So, I mean, if it is making an impact on the Israelis, we haven't seen it yet.
Can I just ask you briefly about relatives of the remaining hostages? As I said, mixed news today about those who Hamas said have died, but the two who were released. Are they still loud voices in terms of protests or demonstrating and highlighting the cause of the hostages who have been held now for 5 months?
Yes, there are. There are people still outside Mr. Netanyahu's property, outside his house. But also, interestingly, one of the relatives of the person who was freed today, he actually said, despite his loved one being freed, that there needs to be a deal to get the rest of the hostages back.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. Now, just going to stay with the situation in Rafah, because Gershon Baskin is a former Israeli hostage negotiator. My colleague Nuala McGovern asked him what he thinks a potential offensive by Israel into the southern Gaza city might look like.
It seems to me that if there will be a military offensive in Rafah, there are 3 main goals. One is to find and rescue more hostages. The second goal would be to find and arrest or kill the Hamas leadership. And the third would be to secure and verify that the border between Gaza and Egypt no longer has any smuggling tunnels under it. Those are the 3 things that Israel needs to do in order to end the war from its perspective. And because they've swept through the Gaza Strip and pushed the civilian population down into the bottom 20% of the Gaza Strip, there are now about 1.5 million Palestinians down there. It makes any military operation very, very complex.
But you talk about a different type of military operation. What would that look like?
There's still apparently a massive underground network of tunnels and bunkers between Khan Yunis and Rafah, where the hostages are probably located and the Hamas leadership is probably located, making their way to secure the Egyptian border. They can't do that without the agreement of Egypt. And I don't think that Egypt is going to agree for Israel to do that simply because of the fear of pushing the civilian population toward Egypt. The solution for the Egyptian border should probably be asking the United States to provide technology and know-how and for the Egyptians to be doing the drilling and searching for tunnels on the Egyptian side of the border where it's calm and quiet and there aren't people.
Let us also talk about the rescue of the two Israeli hostages. How do you think that rescue will affect the talks that are taking place?
Talks are supposed to renew in Cairo. So far, the Israeli war cabinet is supposed to make a decision this evening on whether or not they're sending someone to those talks. There's big pressure from the hostage families to send an Israeli official, senior Israeli official, to those talks. The hostage families are panicking. They're both thrilled by the rescue, but they're also very fearful about what Hamas might do to the other hostages. There's an assumption in the Israeli security that Hamas is probably moving people around again, and that's dangerous all the time whenever hostages are moved from one place to another. There could be a Hamas decision to execute hostages in order to prevent additional Israeli rescue attempts. There's no precedent for this in Israel's history, nor Hamas's experience with Israel and Israeli hostages. My point of view from day one of this war is that the only way to get all the hostages home safely is through an agreement with Hamas. The agreement that's on the table is not acceptable to the Israelis. They see it as surrender and leaving Hamas in place in Gaza. My hope is that the negotiations will continue and they will find some way of agreeing to a ceasefire.
Well, that was Gershon Baskin, a former Israeli hostage negotiator. Now, let's step away from the war between Israel and Hamas. Europe needs a massive and urgent increase in arms production so it can defend itself. That's according to Germany's leader. Chancellor Olaf Scholz's comments came at a ceremony to break ground on a new factory in the north of the country that will ramp up production of shells. The war in Ukraine has exposed shortages in the continent's ability to supply its own arms. From Germany, here's our correspondent Jessica Parker.
Chancellor Scholz dug the first spade into the ground for a new ammunition factory to supply Ukraine and domestic stocks. But Germany is among a majority of NATO nations which are estimated to have fallen short of the 2% defence spending target last year. Donald Trump's suggestion that he'd even encourage aggressors to attack members which didn't pay their dues has sparked fresh alarm in Europe. I asked Armin Papperger, the chief executive of Germany's biggest defence firm Rheinmetall, how long Europe would need to be ready to both help Ukraine and defend itself.
I think we need 10 years. Really, we need 10 years because the stocks are empty. And if you really have an aggressor who wants to fight against the NATO, it's a long time. We are fine in 3-4 years, yes, but to be really prepared, we need 10 years.
Defence experts say the Chancellor's declaration of Zeitenwende, a turning point in defence and foreign policy, has genuinely brought change. But allies want Europe's biggest economy to go further in shedding its traditionally cautious approach. However, nervousness remains in a country where in the 20th century, rearmament led to military and moral catastrophe. Berlin is expected to meet the 2% spending target this year, albeit through a one-off fund. And Chancellor Scholz struck a diplomatic note today, saying he was sure America would stick by NATO.
Next, we're taking you to Poland, one of the staunchest supporters of its neighbour Ukraine since the war there began almost 2 years ago. It's also, though, a country where tensions have boiled over among farmers. They're angry about cheap Ukrainian grain being imported and undercutting their harvest. Well, prosecutors there are investigating claims that some Polish farmers stopped several trucks at the border and emptied some of the grain they were carrying onto the road. Ukraine has urged Poland to hold those farmers to account. I spoke to the BBC's correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton, and began by asking him why Polish farmers were so frustrated with the European Union.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the EU granted Ukrainian tariff-free access to its markets. And Polish farmers are essentially demanding that some form of tougher trade barrier be reintroduced to protect their livelihoods.
Is there any sense among the Polish farming community that those terms were granted to assist Ukraine in defence of its country? Or does this just come down to harsh, pure economics and the realities of being a Polish farmer?
I think the latter, although Poland stunned the world with its extraordinarily humanitarian response to Ukrainian refugees who flooded into the country, and there's still about a million here. 2 years on, I think people have now, particularly if you're a Polish farmer, are concerned about their livelihoods and their ability to pay their mortgages and make a living. With this much cheaper Ukrainian grain, which is flooding into the Polish market and beyond, they're obviously backed by certain political groups and also backed by Poland's small nationalist and far-right groups, that they are voicing their demands. And those demands are being heard. There was a national strike by Polish farmers on Friday last week in more than 250 locations. They blocked roads and officials responded and said, yeah, well, we want to help Ukraine, but we won't do it at the expense of our farmers.
And how challenging is that balance for the government of the relatively new Prime Minister Donald Tusk between maintaining strong support for Ukraine but dealing with those domestic pressures as well? Because on one level, they seem contradictory.
They are contradictory, and this is difficult for Donald Tusk, who, of course, is a former European Council president. He's been visiting Paris today and he's been speaking with Emmanuel Macron, and he's mentioned this. Food security in Poland and in the EU is important. Farmers are protesting in countries right across the European Union, and this has already made the European Commission step back in terms of some of the more stringent regulations they'd like to impose.
Adam Easton. Next, we're going to El Salvador. Days after the country's president, Nayib Bukele, was re-elected, the BBC has been granted rare access to a mega prison there that's become a symbol of his controversial war against gang violence. The government says the Centre for the Confinement of Terrorism, as it calls it, can hold up to 40,000 inmates and, as part of its hardline approach, has no outdoor recreational space. BBC Mundo's Leira Ventas told my colleague Nuala McGovern about her visit.
This is a huge compound built from scratch in the middle of nowhere in a rural area 70 kilometers away from the capital city. And it's the size of 7 football fields. And it's formed by 8 units, like 8 independent prisons. We went inside one of those units, the third unit. The artificial lights never go out. There's a huge corridor in the middle and the cells on sides. Inside the cells, inmates, they are not allowed to leave the cells, just 30 minutes a day. There's no outside recreation. Visits are not allowed, not phone calls allowed. So they sleep inside the cells on metal plates. They eat inside the cells with their hands, rice and beans and eggs and pasta. They wash themselves. They use the toilet inside the cells. That's the situation there.
So that begins to give you an idea of what it's like inside that prison. But this prison is important when it comes to President Bukele's security policy. Can you explain to us how?
Yeah, this prison is emblematic of Bukele's security policy. It's his controversial security policy, but at the same time, the security policy that has granted him the huge popularity, the unprecedented popularity he has, and the success in the polls. He was re-elected with 82.6% of the votes. So this prison, as we said, is emblematic, and as emblematic of its main tool, the state of exception that has been enforced for 2 years now. Around 70,000 people have been detained under these measures that grant draconian powers to the police and the military. And El Salvador has now the highest incarceration rate in the world.
Leira Ventas reporting. Still to come on this podcast.
Yuriko Mamichi has a new routine these days. The 82-year-old oyster farmer has been collecting rainwater from down the hill next to her home.
The BBC's Shama Khalil returns to Japan's remote Noto Peninsula devastated by an earthquake on New Year's Day, to see how the local people are surviving.
Who were the Black 14?
14 football players who were at the University of Wyoming in 1969.
14 student athletes who paid a heavy price for planning a show of support against racism.
It hit the campus like wildfire.
Some of them was getting death threats.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
It was a complete surprise that he kicked us off the team.
What are we going to do with our lives? How are we going to get our degrees?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello again and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, police in Delhi have banned all public gatherings ahead of a threatened march on India's capital on Tuesday by thousands of protesting farmers. Security forces have been deployed and concrete barricades erected on roads into Delhi from neighbouring states. The farmers are demanding greater protections, including guaranteed minimum crop prices. From Delhi, here's Nitin Srivastav.
India's capital is preparing again for a massive farmers' protest. This happened only 2 years back, when hundreds and thousands of farmers had laid siege to borders in Delhi. Bordering states of Punjab, Uttar Pradesh and Haryana were sealed. Traffic was disrupted. The farmers were demanding repeal of farm laws passed by the government in 2020. Now, they plan to start protesting again from the 13th of February. And the demands are same. The farmers want the government to guarantee a minimum support price for their annual yield of crops. They also want pensions to their farmers. And 200 unions across the country also want better working conditions and better promotion of their crops in terms of foreign imports and exports. What's important to be remembered, the government had repealed the laws in 2021 after India's top court had intervened. But the farmers say nothing much has changed, while the government says it is going to be in negotiations with the farmer to avoid a confrontation. Meanwhile, the capital Delhi has banned all processions. Weddings and funerals will need special permission for the government for at least 1 month. Traffic advisories have been issued. The farmers are really adamant. Now, citizens of Delhi and the adjoining areas are really, really bothered as to what the next month is going to be like if that happens again.
Nitin Srivastav reporting from the streets of Delhi. On New Year's Day, a devastating earthquake shook Japan's remote Noto Peninsula, killing more than 200 people. About 55,000 houses were destroyed or badly damaged. The BBC's Shama Khalil has returned to the area to investigate the extent of the devastation and also see how slowly the relief operation appears to be running.
Yuriko Mamichi has a new routine these days. The 82-year-old oyster farmer has been collecting rainwater from down the hill next to her home in the tiny remote village of Mugigaura. The village is in the Noto Peninsula, one of the most remote areas in central Japan. It's where the 7.6 magnitude earthquake hit on New Year's Day. Like tens of thousands in the area, Umamichi-san has been without running water for more than 4 weeks. And this bucket of rainwater she now carries is the only way to wash and clean.
This is my job now. This has been my daily life since the earthquake.
Aid, including food and drinking water, has been coming in. But it's been slow because of how remote the Noto Peninsula is and because of the level of damage to the roads. Many of the affected areas were cut off for days. The main water pipes have also ruptured, and fixing them will take time. Inside, we sit on the floor in Umamichi-san's living room, huddled near the gas stove. It's freezing after days of snow, and she insists on making cups of hot coffee for the whole team. She's in good spirits, but it's been a very difficult start to the year.
In the past few weeks, at least once a day, there'd be aftershocks. We've begun to get used to it. I need to get used to this life. We had no electricity for half a month, and it was pitch black.
There are less than 40 households here in Mugigaura. Unlike the wrecked old wooden homes around her, hers is still intact. But it's been deemed too dangerous to live in. There is a red notice on her front door that reads unsafe in English and Japanese. Many of the homes around the village have the same red sheet of paper. But Umamichi-san says she won't leave.
We're now driving closer to the epicenter. It's a long and slow drive. The Japanese Defense Forces have been bringing in aid and helping with the rescue efforts in the area. Walking through this residential street here in Wajima, or what remains of it, it's very hard to make out the homes. They now feel like just one big pile of rubble. Taichi Kirimoto is a seventh-generation traditional lacquer artist and craftsman, born and raised in Wajima. He takes us to the town's morning market. When the earthquake hit, a fire broke out here. What's been spared by the fire was destroyed in the devastating tremors and aftershocks. We stand in front of the mangled metal structures, which used to be stalls, and Mr. Kirimoto points to his destroyed studio and shop.
I can't put into words how I feel. This is the street of my childhood.
How long do you think it's going to take to restore all of this?
First of all, we need help getting water running again. We need the sewage system to be working again, and then people can think about returning. For craftsmen to start work again, we need running water.
Mr. Kirimoto is anxious about the future of his town. It'll take a long time for Wajima to get back to normal, but the deep sense of loss for its people will linger here for much longer.
Shima Khalil reporting from Japan. Now let's stay in Asia, because traffic jams are the latest issue to cause debate in Thailand about the country's draconian laws that protect its royal family from any public criticism. The Thai Prime Minister, Srettha Thavisin, has ordered tighter security for royal family motorcades after an argument earlier this month led to a brawl between ultra-loyalists and monarchy reformers. Viv Marsh has more.
The blaring of an activist's car horn at the royal motorcade was described in one Thai news outlet as a brazen offence, a defiant honk that echoed far beyond the expressways of Bangkok. The activist live-streamed herself on social media, arguing with the police, who were holding up traffic for the convoy. Local reporters said her car tried to overtake the motorcade. The monarchy in Thailand is widely revered. Insulting it can mean prison. Ultra-royalists angered by the incident clashed with reformists on Saturday at a station. More than a dozen people were injured.
Viv Marsh. Now, this is a lovely listen to end on. To a different era, far away from the current wars and disputes. That is the sound of the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties, and George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. It had its premiere in New York 100 years ago yesterday, the 12th of February, 1924. The Russian composer Igor Stravinsky himself was there for the performance. He'd shocked the classical world a decade before with his Rite of Spring. For more on this, James Naughtie spoke to the pianist Julian Joseph.
The opening of Rhapsody in Blue was a sort of jazz ensemble invention in a way, because the clarinetist just decided to put a big glissando on it. As you feel that freedom in that jazz environment to be able to do something like that. And also, Gershwin improvised most of the cadenzas, if not all of them. And then wrote them out to be played after that first performance.
Looking back on it from this distance, where does this piece sit in the story of a fusion of a kind of jazz vocabulary with a classical tradition?
It sort of comes at a time when there was the jazz zeitgeist in America. The Roaring Twenties is known as the Jazz Age. And I think Rhapsody in Blue, in a funny way, sort of defines that era as a composition that combines, you know, this African-American music into the sort of classical format. And just became something of a musical whirlwind.
Gershwin was only 25 when he wrote it. He wrote it extraordinarily quickly. He talked about it being a kaleidoscope of America. I think they got the idea on a train going from New York to Boston, listening to the rattling on the rails. What is the nature of Gershwin's genius?
Well, he's just one of those special people that comes along every once in a while who really captures the sound of something and is able to put it in many forms. He seemed to really grasp the essence and the roots of the jazz sound, the blues. But that's because, you know, he came up amongst jazz musicians. And it doesn't come from him sort of dipping into it a little bit. He really was a jazz person. He could figure things out himself and then really get the essence of it. And he had this wonderful knack for a tune. And those stand the test of time. And I mean, a piece like Summertime is something we're all aware of. But in jazz music, a piece like I Got Rhythm is something that a lot of other tunes are based on, just the forms.
Gershwin was able to sink into a vocabulary which was much more associated with black jazzmen. And yet he seemed perfectly at home there. It wasn't a problem.
I think society has always been more comfortable with promoting white people doing black things than black people doing black things. So if you take Gershwin as an example, opportunities that he would be given, society was much happier to do that with him rather than with, say, Art Tatum or James P. Johnson or Willie the Lion Smith. That's the nub of it. I think anybody who loves a black art is not doing it to steal it and produce it as their own. The artist isn't trying to do that. Society is trying to do that.
The thoughts of the jazz pianist Julian Joseph. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, as always. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Goodbye.